just because American citizens, many of them, not all of them, but a majority of them live comfortably and guzzle gas nonstop, they should understand where this gas comes from. They should think about the people who live in those parts of the world, how it affects them, and ask themselves a question for the sake of their children and grandchildren and the generations to come. Can we carry on living in a world whose priorities are so upside down? Because what we are seeing now is a world which is very interlinked and interrelated to each other. And it could all go under by the end of this century unless a serious attempt is made to remake this world.
That's Tariq Ali, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Tariq Ali on imperialism, then and now. Joseph Schumpeter, in a 1919 essay entitled The Sociology of Imperialisms, wrote, "There was no corner of the world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that was insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs." Today, if you just substitute United States for Rome, see if there's some resonance and echo. Tariq Ali, born in Pakistan, is an internationally renowned writer, lecturer, and social activist. He's based in London, where he's an editor of New Left Review. He's the author of more than a dozen books on world history and politics. In his spare time, he's a filmmaker and novelist. His latest book is the worldwide bestseller, The Clash of Fundamentalisms: Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. I talked with him at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where some 100,000 people gathered. Welcome to the program, Tariq Ali.
Very good to be with you, David.
Let me start with your definition of imperialism. And I ask that question because this is not a term that is often used in polite discourse in the United States.
Yeah, I've always found that very strange, traveling through the United States, speaking with friends or speaking in public, that it's a word they don't like. And it's a word they used to use a lot when the British Empire was very dominant. I mean, if you looked at liberal magazines like the New Republic, etc., they were constantly attacking the British Empire. And on the eve of the Second World War, a series of articles in the New Republic said there was very little to choose between as far as the British Empire and Hitler were concerned. They were both very similar. So they always had this hostility to the British Empire because of the origins of the American state itself, and therefore they were very reluctant to accept the fact that they themselves had all the makings of an empire from very early on. They assumed that an empire consisted of colonies abroad which were ruled and staffed by people you sent from the imperial country, whether it was Britain in India or France in Algeria or Germany in Namibia or Belgium in the Congo. And they said, well, we don't do it like that. Well, it's true that the United States didn't do it like that, but their very internal expansion, if you like, first by fighting a big civil war to unite their own country, then by expanding, gobbling up bits of Mexico and incorporating them in the United States, they did something which was very similar to what the Tsarist Russia did in the old days of the Russian Empire. By gobbling up countries next to it, they made it part of their own empire, and then it became part of the Tsarist Russia. Here it became part of the United States of America. Then they found a different way of moving forward, which was, I mean, this is where the American empire and American imperialism moved very quickly and very rapidly through the Monroe Doctrine in the 19th century and the early 20th century of taking over Latin America. The Monroe Doctrine said Latin America is our backyard. We are not going to tolerate any trouble there. And if you make a balance sheet of the number of military interventions that were carried out in Latin America, first in the Central American republics, then elsewhere, why were these carried out? Long before there was a revolution in Russia, these were carried out to defend American corporate interests. I mean, hence the word banana republics came into being. It was because American companies were going in there, backed by the Marines, and the American military was securing these countries for the corporations, for American capitalism to grow and triumph. But for a long period, they kept it in their own sphere. What caused them to move out was not so much the need for colonies, which they didn't need in that sense, given the size and scale of the United States itself and the natural resources it possesses, plus the fact that they dominated South America. What forced them to move out was not even the First World War. What compelled them to move out was essentially the Russian Revolution. And there's a very interesting parallel that at the same time as the Russian Revolution was taking place, Woodrow Wilson decided time for a U.S. intervention because they were nervous now that the threatening of capitalist interests in Europe could actually threaten them in the long term. That's when they decided they had to go international. They were quite happy to be a regional power till then. That's where they went international. And that's what basically changed the course of politics, both of the world and of the United States itself. Now, it can be argued that this is a direction they had to go in, that sooner or later the old empires were breaking up, falling apart, a new power had to emerge, and that new power was the United States of America. And the victory of the Russian Revolution meant that it had an enemy, that here was a country which challenged capitalism quite openly and said, we want to create a system which is better than yours. So for 70 years, they fought that system. Finally, they defeated it by forcing it to go on a binge of military spending, which was completely unnecessary. And that they couldn't keep up with. So Russia wasn't invaded or defeated by militarily. It imploded. That was a big, big victory for this empire.
To what extent is imperialism connected or is an outcome of capitalism? Now, you mentioned that Russia expanded and the Soviet Union had quasi, let's say, dependent states.
Yeah.
So could you talk about that?
Well, I think the Soviet expansion after the Second World War was essentially, and I think you'll find most historians agree this, far from being economically exploitative, it was something they needed geographically and militarily to create a network of states which were part of their sphere of influence, part of their social economic system, in order to hold the United States at bay. That was a deal agreed with the Americans and the British at Yalta in 1945, the famous bits of paper, sphere of influence. You can have Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia should be 50-50. Greece is ours, so if there's a revolutionary movement there, we'll crush it and you stay out of it. That's how the whole deal was done. But leaving that aside, because that is largely now of historical interest, you see, all the early empires were founded by the need for capital to expand, the need for capital to find new markets. And it was this struggle for markets that finally created the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the Belgian Empire, the French Empire. And the First World War was a war fought over colonial expansion. Who would control the trade routes? Who would control the markets? Germany, which had unified late and come to capitalism later than the other powers, decided it wanted its own empire, but it felt that the way to get it was to defeat Britain, and then it could actually move forward. So this was the case in the past. For a while, this got disguised, because while the Soviet Union and that whole block of states existed, there was talk of imperialism, but by and large, people in the West saw this as essentially we're fighting a war against an evil enemy, an evil empire, etc., etc. It wasn't seen as that. Now the slate is clean once again. So we have the world before us naked. We see exactly what is going on in this world. And the latest strategy doctrine put out by the Bush administration makes it crystal clear what all this is about. They say a holy moral principle is the defense of free trade, i.e. free trade as we see it and according to rules which we make and how we regulate it. And in order to defend this, we are prepared to go to war. Well, that has been the principle of all empires. Now, the difference between the American Empire and the previous empires is that the United States always, or not always, usually prefers to work through local compradors, local rulers who are on their side. They don't like ruling directly because they know it's an enormous expense. Why send your own people out to run a country when you can find locals to do it? And that is how they've always operated. By and large, even after they occupied Japan after the Second World War, there was very little, I mean, there was American, they created a constitution and MacArthur was like a viceroy. But they pulled out of that quite soon and let their local relays in Japan carry on as they still do. The Japanese Liberal Democratic Party was created by the United States to do the job for them. And this is the way they do it. And it's very interesting that even in the latest case of Afghanistan, which is now a colonial state, they didn't want to have their own people there pending a general election. They put a puppet, former employee of the CIA and an oil company, Hamid Karzai, in power in Kabul, and he does the work for them, even though they can't leave him undefended, which they could in some other cases where people had built up their own armies. The question now is this: who are the rivals of the United States globally? And how is it going to defend its interest against them? Well, Europe is a rival. Because they are, economically speaking, not politically or militarily, not the European Union so much, because it's a weak entity, but certainly Germany and France are construed off as economic rivals. Their firms go into the same markets. This notion that we now have multinational capital the nation state is irrelevant, I don't buy that for a minute. You do have multinationals, but we know very clearly what the ownership of these multinationals is. Some of them are based in the United States, some of them are based in other places but owned by the Germans, some by the French, etc., etc. So the nation state is still very important to defend the interests of these so-called multinationals, which are multinational only in terms of exploitation, but in terms of their base and their roots, they are tied to these particular nation states. And so this rivalry between the United States and its imperial economic interests and some of the European countries are clear. And at a distance, they see essentially the Far Eastern region, United Korean Peninsula, Japan, and China as a combination which could be deadly if it ever got together, either economically or politically and militarily. And they feel and they fear that if this happened, within 10 years, this area would become completely hegemonic economically. And so American strategic policy is designed to keep these countries separate from each other. That's why the Bush regime is now even trying to stop Korean reunification, because they are fearful that a unified Korean Peninsula with nuclear weapons would make the Japanese go for nuclear weapons. Then you have three nuclear powers in the region, Japan, Korea, and China. And if that ever happened, I think they would try and make them fight each other. That would be the way they would try and provoke it, because they are really fearful of a link-up in this region that would threaten their interests very severely. So now we have basically, and to be frank, it isn't even concealed that much anymore by many of the supporters of Bush who are writing in the American press, quite openly. I mean, if you read Thomas Friedman's article on the war in Iraq, this guy spells it out. He says it's laughable to pretend it's not about oil. Quite open. He says it's not just about oil. And of course we know it's not just about oil, but he says oil does play a big part in it. So they are no longer even trying to keep a veil to conceal the real aims. They are saying this is the situation. We're the world's mightiest power. These are our economic interests. These are our strategic interests. These are our geopolitical interests. And you better watch out, guys, because we're going to defend them. This is imperialism, quite open, different from the past, in a new situation. And the war in Iraq is a way in which they will assert new raw imperial power in a way they've not done so before.
Walter Rodney, the great Guyanese political thinker and writer, talked about what he called the local lackeys of imperialism, something you just touched upon briefly. Tell me more about this class of collaborators, as it were, that are inside these countries that essentially, I think as you suggest, serve the metropolitan center.
And this has now been such a systematic pattern throughout the 20th century that we can follow it very closely. You had a whole period in the middle of the 20th century of the rise of nationalism, the rise of anti-colonial movements, the rise of national liberation movements against the old empires. But already standing behind the old empires was the shadow of the United States of America. And as the old empires were going down, they were being replaced by the power of the United States of America. So what happens in the middle of the last century? You have a Korean War, a three-year war fought by the United States under the banner of the United Nations, in the course of which war the industrially strong part of Korea, which was the North, is destroyed completely. Not a single building was left standing. Its entire structure was destroyed, and then they pulled out and agreed to a ceasefire. Then you had the Vietnam War. First, the French were defeated in Vietnam. The United States weren't prepared to see that defeat and stepped in. And for the first time, the United States leaders thought of using nuclear weapons. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, suggested to Western allies and the French that perhaps in order to stop these ants crawling up the hills around Dien Bien Phu, the big battle where the French were defeated, and when he referred to ants, he was referring to the Vietnamese people, they could be destroyed. I answer your question like this, David, because without understanding the national movements and the role they played, we can't understand properly the role of the collaborators. So the aim of the American empire was, by hook or by crook, to get rid of these governments somehow, to maintain a nationalist pretense, and to get in a different group of people who could pretend to be anti-colonial nationalists but would actually be serving the needs of the great metropolitan empire. How did they do this? They failed in Vietnam, as we know. They succeeded in dividing Korea, but they couldn't rule South Korea democratically, because no lackeys could be found who could be elected. So when you don't find lackeys who can be elected democratically, you put the army in power. They did exactly the same in Pakistan. That when a general election was planned for April 59, which would have returned a government which would have withdrawn from the security pacts into which they tied Pakistan, they organized a coup d'etat and put the military in power in October 1958 to preempt a general election. The country which worried them the most in the middle of the last century was Indonesia, because this country had the world's largest communist party outside China and Russia, a party with 1 million members, with an additional 2 million people organized in front organizations, a communist power of 3 million people with big influence on the government and within the armed forces. So what do? They organized one of the most dastardly actions we have seen since the Second World War, a military coup where they put Suharto in power, and so the only way Suharto could stay in power was by killing a million people. The wiping out of the most powerful social movement in the country, and the killings in the countryside where the communists had organized the peasants were on a very high pitch. So they killed a million people, and as Time magazine put it quite bluntly, the best news the West has had from Asia for a long time. It was a big victory for them. And on the basis of that victory, they found a local collaborator, Suharto, who stayed in power till the end of the 20th century. A dictator, much more vicious than anything we have seen in Iraq, came to power on a mountain of corpses, invaded East Timor, killed people there, wiped out all the secular radical oppositions in the country, and then people are surprised how come the Islamists are so powerful, because the Islamists are the people who were used in 65 to kill. Go on killing Reds, go and wipe them out, they're atheists, they're communists, kill, 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 kill. So that is how collaborators are created. And then you had a new phase, which is the post-Cold War phase, where basically the triumph of the United States and world capitalism totally disarmed even semi-nationalist politicians who said, now there's nothing else to do, just work with them, serve them. And this led to a phenomenal growth in corruption all over the Third World, and not just the Third World, in the First, Second Worlds as well. Massive corruption in politics. Politics became part of corporate life, which they've been in the States for some time, but that process then began to seep through. And it's been very difficult now for the last 20 years to get elected leaders who are prepared to fight for their own people and the rights of their own state. Interestingly enough, we're having this interview in Latin America, and this is a continent which has been in revolt now for some time. You've seen the election of Chavez, you've seen the failure to topple Fidel Castro after 40 years of the blockade, you've just seen a phenomenal victory of Lula in Brazil, where we are sitting and talking, we've seen the victory of Guterres in Ecuador, Evo Morales in Bolivia came very close to defeating the corporation's candidate. So we are seeing beginnings of a new wave of, let's call it, sub-nationalism or proto-nationalism, which wants to resist and doesn't know how to resist. So maybe we are now reaching a period where this model could spread elsewhere. But by and large, in Asia and Africa, they have so far pliable regimes. I don't think it can last indefinitely, this. And I think, curiously enough, the war in Iraq and the occupation of Iraq and the substitution of Saddam with a U.S. puppet government so the oil can be shared out as trophy, war trophy, is bound to create a resistance sooner or later. It may take 4 years, it may take 10 years, we don't know, but it will happen. So in that sense, the American empire is no different from other empires. It is slowly sowing the seeds of the forces that will one day confront it. But the confrontation in the case of the United States has also to come from within America itself. It's very interesting that that's where Seattle was, where the anti-globalization movement was born. And I would like to remind, through you, American listeners, that the first anti-imperialist league ever created was created in Chicago in 1898 or 9 by Mark Twain and by various other American anti-imperialists who identified imperialism as the major problem. And some of Mark Twain's his anti-imperialist writings, and he was reacting to the American occupation of the Philippines, where they did a deal basically with the Spanish, which they were to do later with the French in Vietnam. You get out of the Philippines, we'll have some mock battle, you know, fake wrestling, as we used to call it in our part of the world, and we'll take over. And they did, and they saw the crushing of the national movement, and that drove people like Mark Twain and others completely wild. And this league was created in Chicago, and within a year it had 250,000 people as members in 30 different cities. And that was a time when there was no communism, no social enemies like that on a world scale, but imperialism still existed. And brave and intelligent American citizens could see that it existed. And I honestly think that the time has come again for the heirs of Mark Twain and the other pioneers of that anti-imperialist league to get together and create such a body once again. Because it's much more dangerous now than it was then, because its military power is virtually unchallengeable because of the technological developments that there have been made in that field. So it's really vital, and this organization will fight the empire morally from within its own heart. So I'm very keen that this happens.
Clearly, 19th century European imperialism was predicated on racism, the white man's burden, bringing Christianity and enlightenment to the benighted natives, as it were. That was then. What about now? What factor does racism play in imperialism?
Well, as you very rightly said, this was the basis of the old empires. And yet, there is a similarity between old and new. When I read the propaganda and the rhetoric behind the wars of so-called humanitarian intervention, it was very interesting. It's interesting they dropped that rhetoric for Iraq. It's sort of quite naked as far as Iraq is concerned. It's weapons of mass destruction rather than humanitarian intervention. But when they went into the Balkans, they used the rhetoric of humanitarian intervention. And I was reminded then that the propaganda of the British as they took a large chunk of the African continent was humanitarian intervention. We are going in there basically to destroy slavery. This from a country which had benefited and profited enormously from slavery. Most of the big fortunes and the big country estates which people go and look at in Britain were built on slavery. The slave trade played a very big part in the formation economically, socially, culturally of what became the British ruling class in the 18th century and the early years of the 19th. So the humanitarian intervention reminded me of that a bit, but the racist motive has declined. They don't use it that much. In fact, they try and bend over backwards to avoid using it because they know it's quite explosive. But look, you can't deny the underlying feeling of white superiority in all this. And I'll give you a concrete example. The tragedy of 9/11, when lots of civilians were killed in New York and some in Washington, the whole world was forced to weep for them in public. They didn't, but that was the general mood of the media. Why? Because they were citizens of the United States of America. When Afghan citizens are killed by indiscriminate bombings, by so-called accidental bombings, bombing of a wedding because they were firing a few shots there and someone thought, oh God, we're being attacked, so go and bomb them. And they did. The deaths now which are taking place from starvation, as you have these Terminator-style helicopters and tanks driving past villages, past Afghan refugees who have no shelter in the snows of this region. So these deaths don't count for much. No one will ever build a monument for the Afghan civilians who died in the bombing raids which followed that. Just a crude war of revenge, as I called it at the time. Why not? Why are Afghan lives not as important as any other lives? Because underlying all this is still the belief that we are a superior nation and we are a superior race and we are a superior peoples.
You're listening to Tariq Ali on imperialism then and now. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling the following toll-free number, 1-800 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
And sometimes it's very frightening when these sorts of racist attitudes, and this is where Frantz Fanon had a great deal to teach us, penetrate even people of color who live in the heartland of the great empire and suddenly feel that everything they have suffered can somehow be substituted by turning on another people and saying that somehow what is happening to them is very different from what was experienced by black people or colored people or Chicano people inside the United States of America itself. It's not universally the case, but it is the case, I have noticed. And it's not surprising. I mean, one would have to, you know, obviously there are reasons for it, material reasons for this to happen. And the same thing, the cavalier way in which casualties are discussed in the case of Iraq. There was a conference, I'm told, organized by the State Department and its favorite Iraqis, where an Iraqi friend of mine went in who wasn't on their list. And he told me, he said, you know, Tariq, what shocked me, was the way they were discussing casualties. How many civilian deaths would be acceptable? And he said the figure they were talking about amongst themselves, the Iraqis and the Americans, was, well, 250,000, it shouldn't go above that. A quarter of a million civilian deaths acceptable when 2,000 deaths are not acceptable in the United States of America? But a quarter of a million Iraqi lives are acceptable. What is that, if not the most grotesque demonstration that the lives of these poor Arabs don't matter a damn? So we are still, it's different, the form it takes is very different from the old empires, but it's still there.
There's a privileging of victims. When Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations before she became Secretary of State, she was asked about the impact of sanctions on Iraq, and specifically the death of 500,000 Iraqi children. And the journalist asked, well, do you think the price is worth it? And she said, yes, the price is worth it.
That is one of the most shocking statements made by a senior American politician or leader, I think, since the Second World War. It's just amazing that this didn't create mayhem in the United States. I mean, if that statement had been made by Lyndon Baines Johnson in 68 or Nixon in 70-71, that it's a killing 2 million Vietnamese, there would have been absolute pandemonium. People would have been rushing to attack the White House, demonstrating, laying siege, saying, withdraw your words. The fact that Madeleine Albright said this on CBS News to Leslie Starr and was not reprimanded for it by her president is just deeply shocking. And, you know, then they came back and said, oh, well, Saddam's responsible for that. But that, excuse me, let's leave that aside for a moment. That's not what you were asked. You were asked, the sanctions have cost 500,000 children's lives in Iraq, and you said that's a price worth paying. Now, what can one even say to a politician like that? This is, you know, I know people hate hearing this, but this is the sort of rhetoric which used to be used by the Third Reich in the 30s. That the deaths of so many people are fine. They're Untermensch. They are not like us. These are different people. Their lives don't concern us. And the same sort of rhetoric we'll hear, trying to blame the victims for what you are doing to them. It's quite staggering. And it's not the case that this the figure of 500,000 was pulled out of the air by the CBS News people. It's the official United Nations figure, supplied by United Nations organizations who've been in that country. And the the genocidal impact of sanctions on Iraq forced two senior United Nations officials, Dennis Halliday and Hans Sponnick, to resign in disgust. Why did they resign? Because they were crazed radicals of some sort, or Islamists? Because they were decent, liberal human beings who could not tolerate what was being done in the name of the United Nations to the people of Iraq? And if there were any justice in this world, the politicians, Albright, Clinton, Blair, and others who pushed these sanctions through would be tried before a criminal court, saying, why did you do that? The aim had clearly failed to weaken the regime. What you did was to make the people more dependent on the regime. So what the hell do you think you were playing at? Denying Iraq the right to get in basic equipment to restore its sanitary, the sewage, to repair the sewage systems. All this stuff was denied to them. And they were not allowed to import from any single country. So, and not to mention the depleted uranium used in the Gulf War, which caused heavy cancer casualties on ordinary children born with large cancers after that war. Mm. So this is where we see empires at their worst, and this is where we see this empire at its worst. So David, I have to say to you, I mean, just remember, when you look at some amongst the worst atrocities of the British Empire in India, Jallianwala Bagh episode in 1919, you know, where they killed several hundred people, but several hundred, David, several hundred, and the outcry there was in the world. And the outcry there was in the world when the Belgian king started killing lots of Congolese people, a massive outcry. You know, Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, wrote a book called Atrocities in the Congo, which sold 200,000 copies in 2 months. Massive worldwide campaign against those atrocities. Now it's almost as if the world has gone to sleep, that they're so comfortable and secure in Europe and North America that killing people and the deaths of ordinary civilians don't matter a damn. They all serve some cause. And I put it to you that the cause they serve is the cause of the American empire.
Well, talk about the role of the media in shaping and forming public opinion and ideas that, for example, Saddam Hussein represents a grave threat to the United States. And also, if you could mention, contrast the media in Britain with the United States. It's a little bit different.
No, there is a difference. I mean, whenever I'm in the United States, what really shocks me first is the television coverage of the rest of the world. It's hardly ever there. And it's almost as if the only way they can teach people geography is by going and bombing countries. Oh, you don't know where Afghanistan is? It's here. Look, we're bombing it. You don't know where Iraq is? It's here. We're going to be bombing it very soon. We're going to bomb it. Then you'll know where it is. And so you have a population which is not informed or educated by the media, except when it's time for war. And when they suddenly find a country, pick it out, attack its regimes, it's a process which can only be described as propaganda, of the most disgusting sort. You don't allow people to think for themselves. You frighten them. This notion of Saddam Hussein being a threat to the United States makes everyone in Europe laugh, including European politicians who talk to the American leaders every day. They just laugh. And the American media's coverage, for instance, of the Israeli occupation of Palestine and what's been going on that front is so deeply shocking that it's so one-sided. It's almost as if the Palestinians were occupying Jewish lands and the Israelis were resisting back against a big force of Palestinians. That really depressed me no end, because it's not, so completely against the reality of what is going on there. So I do think, that the, by and large, the reporting in the American media is part and parcel of what's happening. And it's essentially the need to use the media to create an institutional depoliticization. Don't write anything which might make people think, because if you do it, God, they might think things we don't want them to think. And then where would we be? This is what neoliberal economics, globalization, has done to the functioning of democracy, actually beginning to damage it very, very seriously. Now, in Europe, the situation is slightly different. You have still newspapers which will publish critical articles. It gets bad during a war, I have to say this, David. It gets bad when the country is actually involved in a war. But on Iraq, for instance, and Palestine, you have had coverage in the British, French, and Italian newspapers, of which you will find no equivalent in the United States, with the partial occasional exception of the LA Times, which sometimes publishes very critical stuff. I read it on the net. But with that exception, you find that the European press allows far more space and far more news reportage of events which are taking place more objectively than anything in the United States itself.
What's your analysis of Tony Blair? Why is he such an enthusiastic partner of George Bush in his war on terrorism?
I think the problem with Tony Blair is that he actually believes in it. He is a deeply conservative man. Have absolutely no doubt about it. He would have been a good leader of the British Conservative Party. He probably too right-wing for some conservatives, but he would have been perfectly at home there. He has underlying Blair, which very few people talk about, but he has a streak of Christian fundamentalism in him, which goes very deep. And there has been around him a Christian mafia, which is quite authoritarian in its social attitudes and beliefs. And in terms of foreign policy, I think Blair decided very early on, after he came to office, that he was going to continue the deals Thatcher had done with Reagan. What these deals have done, basically, especially after the Malvinas-Falklands conflict, is that they have docked the British Ministry of Defence totally into the Pentagon. So much so that when the Pentagon upgrades, the British Ministry of Defence, which doesn't need to do it, has to do it because it's part of the same system. And Britain now, the British, I can't say it's the British elite, because the British elite is divided, but certainly the British political class, Labour and Conservative, are totally committed to this alliance. And it reminds you of what Charles de Gaulle used to say when he kept Britain out of the common market, when he kept on vetoing British entry into the common market. And he used to say that this will always be an American Trojan horse in the American Union. How right he was. And Blair likes to go and tell the Europeans, it's very important I'm close to Bush because I can influence him. And he tells Bush, it's very important I'm in the European Union because I can make sure that your views are properly defended in there. That's the role this guy plays. Look, I mean, underlying it, Blair's civility to the United States is how he sees the country. He sees it. Britain, and this is a fact, Britain is a medium-sized northern European country. It no longer has an empire. It has quite an exploitative, deregulated system inside Britain, which attracts foreign capital because wages are low. Taxes are low. This is what Thatcher achieved. And he believes this has to be maintained because he doesn't have any other vision. And one of the ways it can be maintained is by totally hanging alongside the United States in whatever they do, sharing part of the proceeds and being seen by the United States as their loyalist ally. It's classic. Satraps used to do it in the days of the Roman Empire, more loyal to the empire than many people inside the empire itself who could see the realities of what they were doing. And that's what Blair has consciously decided he wants to be, a loyal satrap of the American Empire. I have to also tell you, because it'd be one-sided not to do so, that he is hated by large numbers of people in the Britain for doing this, including the British establishment, who find that this is incredibly debased and vulgar and low, this sort of civility to the United States. And both within the Mandarin, the civil service establishment, and the military establishment, there is a lot of nervousness and hostility to the war on Iraq. So, and for the first time also in Britain, you have a majority of public opinion against the war. So Blair is really in some ways putting his future along the line. And one more feature about him, which, I mean, there is the Christianity, there is the belief that his future is tied with the United States. But David, he's also a very greedy man. He's obsessed with money. He's always telling people at private dinner parties how being Prime Minister of Britain has meant that he's not earning as much money as he should be. And when politicians combine this piety on the one hand and greed on the other, and then are prepared to justify wars, you just get a very mixed up, internally mixed up politician. And he has recently shown signs of cracking. When you look at him, he's looking very strained, very tense, etc. So the one good thing which might come out from the war on Iraq is that the end of Blair as a politician. I mean, and this is probably wishful thinking, but many people think that he won't stay long now.
Noam Chomsky, among others, has suggested that the United States, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has been fervently looking for an oppositional force to replace it. And they tried a couple of things, Noriega in Panama, Gaddafi for a while, the drug lords, the cartels in Cali and Medellin were a great threat to the United States. And it seems now that they've really zoomed in on Islam, a certain variant of Islam, fundamentalist Islam, militant Islam, as the new arch enemy.
Well, they have indeed. And I think the one thing they've got agreement on with the rest, with large numbers of other countries, is that Islamic fundamentalist terrorism is a bad thing, and this is an enemy which has to be wiped out and destroyed. But, you know, where do you go from there? Because unless you understand what causes young people to decide to sacrifice their own lives, what is the process, and how do you stop that process, this thing can go on. So in order to justify infinite war, they have invented this enemy, which, you know, I'm almost tired of pointing this out, is something they created themselves at the height of the Cold War to service their needs in Indonesia, in Afghanistan, in the Arab world. They supported the people they now call their main enemies in order to destroy nationalist regimes, in order to destroy radical regimes which threaten their interests. Now these people have broken loose because the Americans dumped them. They said, we don't need you anymore. And they said, well, you may not need us anymore, but we believe we have a role to play. And that's essentially what's going on. And so, it's crazy to sort of make Islam into a monolith. It's just as divided as any other part of the world. It's suffered from the 20th century, just like every other country has. I mean, the point I was making to you earlier. I mean, when we were kids, we used to say as a quiz to each other, or not kids, but college students in Lahore, we used to say, which is the largest Muslim country in the world? Indonesia. Which is the largest communist party in the world outside the communist world? Indonesia. People say, really? Really? Is that so? How did this happen? How it happened is because that's how the 20th century affected the whole world, including the Islamic world. And it's been the wiping out of these currents which has created this monster, which the United States now pretends is a big enemy. How is it a big enemy? Maximum number of people Al-Qaeda has, 3,000. maybe 4, though no one's agreed on it. It's definitely somewhere between 2 and 3,000 ensconced in different parts of the world, including parts of Europe and the United States of America. So how come this can't be destroyed? I mean, you know, it could be, but the problem is not Al-Qaeda. The problem is the conditions which create this mood which drives young people to despair. And that you cannot get away from. And that will not stop unless the central problems in the Middle East, Palestine, Israel, what's been done to Iraq are solved. That's one reason why the war in Iraq, far from being a war against terrorism, is going to be a war. It should be called a war to promote terrorism, because people will feel our governments have let this happen. There's nothing they can do. What are we going to do? How are we going to respond when the historic city of Islamic civilization, the city of the Khalifas and the Thousand and One Nights, is once again occupied by crusaders? That's what they'll see. And it is seen in the Arab world as a crusade for oil. And the reason they've made Islam the big enemy now is because it's underneath Islamic lands, which is an accident of geography and history. But the richest deposits of oil lie underneath Muslim lands. You know, there's oil in Brunei, a Muslim country in the Far East. There are big deposits. Iraq has got the second largest deposits of oil. Iran has oil. The Arab Peninsula has oil. Saudi Arabia. I mean, you just count it on your fingers. If there was no oil underneath the Islamic world, it was somewhere else. Let's suppose in all the oil or the bulk of the oil was in Africa. That would be the enemy, whatever it was. You know, saying they're not proper Christians, they've never learned proper Christianity, whatever. So it's, I think the reason now that Islam is the enemy is tied very closely to oil and the needs of the West in controlling this region and making sure it never goes out of that control as long as the globe exists. That's the plan.
Talk to the average American listener who's going to hear this broadcast. Well, even though you've said many interesting things, Mr. Ali, but, you know, I'm not quite sure. How do I get a better understanding of what the United States is doing and how the world system operates? What suggestions can you make for me?
Well, the suggestions I would make is that, you know, please don't ignore history. One of the things that has happened in our culture as a whole, not just in the United States, but also in Europe and other parts of the world, that history as a subject has become devalued. And if you read the history of the United States itself, not just, you will find not just the history of an empire in the making, but you will also find the history of dissent in the United States. And you will also find many surprising things, that Walt Whitman, for instance, who is supposed to be the poet of liberation and the anti-slavery and pro-Lincoln, which he was later in his life. But in his earlier years, Walt Whitman was a firm believer in America and the American whites as a superior civilization which had the right to crush Mexicans because it was a second-rate civilization. He actually said as much. And there was a lot of ambiguity in the early American poets and writers about what they felt about American expansionism. This changed by the end of the 19th century with Mark Twain and with Whitman in his last years, by the way. But after the end of the Civil War, he was a deeply shaken man when he saw how much blood had been spilled. So it made these people think. And you know, what I always say to my American friends is that America is a very rich country in every way. It's rich economically. It is rich in the dissenting movements which have grown up within it. And it's rich also in a country which has committed atrocities all over the world. And you have to choose which of these riches you want. Martin Luther King, the year he died, said, one of the things that has shocked me is to discover that the greatest purveyor of violence on earth is my own country. And I think people should learn from that, that the most gifted and capable American dissenters, many of whom were killed by the state, by the way, historically, are people who have stood up and fought. And I think just because American citizens, many of them, not all of them, but a majority of them live comfortably and guzzle gas nonstop, they should understand where this gas comes from. They should think about the people who live in those parts of the world, how it affects them, and ask themselves a question for the sake of their children and grandchildren in the generations to come. Can we carry on living in a world whose priorities are so upside down? Because what we are seeing now is a world which is very interlinked and interrelated to each other. And it could all go under by the end of this century unless a serious attempt is made to remake this world. Just ask themselves that and ask, isn't that something worth striving for in the interests of the generations to come, instead of just thinking selfishly about our own needs?
You were just listening to an interview with Tariq Ali on imperialism, then and now. I talked with him in late January 2003 at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. Tariq Ali, born in Pakistan, is an internationally renowned writer, lecturer, and social activist. He's based in London, where he's an editor of the New Left Review. Author of many books, his latest is The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent award-winning weekly series. AR features such voices as Noam Chomsky, Asad Abu Khalil, Arundhati Roy, Edward Said, Pervez Hoodboy, and Hanan Ashrawi. To access our catalog, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for the complete one-hour program you just heard, Tariq Ali on Imperialism Then and Now, just call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can send in your check. CDs and cassettes are $15. Printed transcripts are $9. Our address, AR, P.O. Box 551. Boulder, Colorado, 80306. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.